Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Elise Blackwell. Blackwell is an assistant professor in the English department at the University of South Carolina. She's the author of two highly acclaimed novels. Her first, Hunger, takes place during the siege of Leningrad in 1941 and was named a Los Angeles Times Best Book of 2003. Her second novel, The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish, was published in April by Unbridled Books. This novel covers the 1927 flood that devastated parts of southern Louisiana, an eerie parallel to 2005's Hurricane Katrina. I'm talking to Elise Blackwell by phone from her home in South Carolina. Elise Blackwell, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, listen, I want to start with a question. Did you always want to be a writer?
Yes, I did, at least since I was about 5 years old. I loved to read. And about that age, my grandfather sat me down and said he would pay me a dollar for every story or poem that I wrote. And that got me going. And then I got rather too prolific. And one week he had to give me about $10, which was a lot of money for a five-year-old at that time. And he said, I hope you'll keep writing, but not for the money. And he stopped paying me.
Oh, wow.
At that point. But I've been writing ever since.
What an interesting incentive.
I'm not sure it's ultimately a good incentive for a writer of literary fiction, but it was good advice when he told me to stop writing for the money, but to keep writing.
Yeah, I bet that $10 is probably a big amount.
It was a lot of money for a five-year-old at that time, yeah. And I don't think he realized I would be quite so gung-ho.
Now, I want to talk to you about your first novel, Hunger. It was published in 2003, and it takes place during the siege of Leningrad in the winter of 41. Tell us about it and how you got interested in this subject.
I actually came to it through the botany. A lot of people ask me if I had a relative in the siege of Leningrad or if I'm from Russian descent, but I came to it through the botany. Both my parents are botanists, and when I was living out in California, I was extremely interested in the seed savers movement and started growing a lot of rare beans and vegetables and exotic fruits. And through that organization, I learned the true story upon which Hunger is based, about a group of biologists who preserved a rare seed collection during the siege of Leningrad. And about two dozen of them starved to death, protecting this collection of seeds that, if they had eaten it, might have saved their lives. And I was just fascinated by the idea that anyone could do that.
Hmm. Did your parents have a lot of influence on the writing as well?
To some degree. My father also writes. He writes some poetry in addition to being a botanist. And they helped me some with the information. My mom ran down a little information for me on the Vavilov Institute. But I can't blame them for the shape of the novel, and I don't show my first drafts to anyone while I'm writing them, not even my parents.
Now, I want to ask you this. Since the experience of sending off your first novel is fairly fresh, since it happened in 2003, was it hard to let it go? Was it like sending a child into the world?
It was. I had written before a couple of novels that weren't published, and so I sort of forgot the idea of writing to be read. It was slightly traumatic when I realized that people were actually going to be reading this book that I had written in complete solitude, alone in my study. On the other hand, I was very happy to receive readers, and the first reviews I got and a few letters from people who read the book was extremely gratifying to have the audience at the end of all that work.
Mm-hmm. But I assume that you were probably sort of afraid for its safety at first, huh?
Terrified, in fact, and the very first review I got was the most negative review I got. And I thought, is this what it's going to be like? My dreams come true and I only feel like I want to hang myself. Then it got better.
Yeah, I would assume so. It got really good reviews in the ensuing months.
It did. Like the negative review was out of the way quickly.
That's great. Now, let's talk about the new novel. This past April, your second novel came out, The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish. Now, this one's about the flood of 1927 that devastated southern Louisiana. Tell us about this.
Yes, it's based in part on the memoirs of my maternal grandfather, the man who paid me a dollar for those stories way back when. He wasn't a writer, he was an educator, but he was a very interesting man. His grandparents were illiterate. His parents, I believe, had a fourth and eighth grade education. And through a love of science and learning and education, he went on to become a dean of a university. In his 80s, he sat down and wrote his memoirs, and he never meant for them to be published. They were just a gift for the family. And every Christmas and once in the summer, there would be sort of white boxes waiting for us, and he gave chapters to each of his children and grandchildren. And I always wanted to do something with some of his information growing up in rural Louisiana in the 1920s. And some years later, I had the idea to put it together and tell the story against the 1927 flood that devastated several parishes south of New Orleans, and started to do research on the flood.
And can you tell us a little bit about the book and some of the characters?
Sure. It's a coming-of-age story, both for my main character, Louis Proby, who turned 17 during the 1927 flood, and it's also a coming-of-age story for a place. In the 1920s, rural Louisiana was, for better and for worse, becoming more like the rest of the country. People were driving cars, listening to the radio. For the first time, people heard people who didn't have Southern accents speak on the radio. They were shopping out of catalogs. They were getting to big cities in numbers that they had never gone before. Of course, it's a coming-of-age story that, for both Louis Proby and Louisiana, was interrupted by the 1927 flood. Louis is, like my grandfather was, is the son of a lumber company town superintendent in a time when Louisiana was going from rural to a bit more urban, a bit more suburban. He also has access, working as a driver, to a character named Charles Segris, who has a chance to visit New Orleans and is tempted there by champagne and jazz and women with short skirts. And through those trips to New Orleans, he also learns about the plan to dynamite the levees south of New Orleans, and that's based on historical fact. In 1927, partly due to memories of the 1922 flood in Louisiana, a group of bankers and politicians, but mostly bankers, people who didn't even hold elected office, got together and decided that to preserve the image that New Orleans was safe from flooding and to protect capital in the city from fleeing north, they decided to dynamite the levees south of the city. And they flooded out about a million people south of New Orleans, most of Plaquemine and St. Bernard parishes. Some people died, and many, many, many people were left homeless by that decision.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting book. Now, in this book, you also touch on some of the grim realities of your home state. Segregation, outbreaks of leprosy that was prevalent to certain parts of the country back then. Talk to us a little bit about that. And did your research surprise you in some of this?
It did. I had grown up hearing about the Carville leper colony as my grandmother talked about it, and had never stopped to think about it. I knew lepers from the Old Testament and from hearing about Carville. And in my research, I learned that Louisiana is one of the last places in the continental United States to have leprosy, and there still are cases of leprosy infection down there. And my research revealed that it comes from eating infected armadillo meat. There's that terrible joke, how do you know you're at a Cajun zoo? There's a recipe under every cage. And it's true that a lot of people in rural Louisiana hunt and find their own food still to this day, and they tend to eat things like alligator, armadillo, snake. And it's one of the causes of leprosy. I was also stunned by some of the research I found on just sort of the tenacious racial politics of Louisiana, which, of course, experienced Jim Crow in a slightly different way from the rest of the country, but experienced it no less virulently.
Then your novel was really quite haunting, and I was really taken by the fact that the Mississippi River was a main character. Talk to us about what you found out about that river.
Well, that's a good observation. I grew up near the river, and I had always been told never, ever, ever go in it. It's very, very dangerous. But I hadn't realized how dangerous and how much of a living body of water it is. Whole cows can disappear in the river and never come out again. So I was just stunned by sort of the fluid mechanics of the river and how dangerous it is. I also did a lot of history, research on the history of how the river has been controlled over the years and the attempts to control. And one thing I found out, and for anyone who's interested, I highly recommend the nonfiction book Rising Tide by John Barry, which gives a great history of, among other things, levee policy on the Mississippi River. And I saw that decisions made centuries ago fed into the levee policy that led to the 1927 flood. Among other things, there was a decision to rely only on levees and not to use natural spillways or artificial spillways, and that was a contributing factor in 1927.
Now, it really is fascinating that this novel was being written when the modern-day catastrophe was hitting Louisiana, of course, Hurricane Katrina. Now, you've visited down there. Tell us some of your observations about what's happening right now.
Sure. It was very difficult for me. The novel was actually done and sitting on an editor's desk when I first heard the words hurricane and Katrina side by side. After, 7 weeks later, the hurricane had come, devastated the southern Louisiana, and gone, and the novel was still sitting unread on that same editor's desk. My agent called me and said, "Do you think the book is more relevant now?" And it was a very troubling question. I was not sure what to do with the book. I actually pulled it back, wrote another novel in the meantime, and then decided I didn't want to let The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish go, and I revised it to sort of take some kind of account of Katrina. It's now narrated on the eve of Katrina, but it's funny how little the story had to change to accommodate Katrina, because the parallels between 1927 and 2005 are so stunning. Including the contributions of the decisions of human beings on how they complicated the natural disaster. And on my book tour, this past summer, I started in Bay St. Louis near Biloxi, and I was stunned by how devastated that town still is. It went from a population of 8,000 to a population of 1,000 overnight.
Wow.
And most of those homes are still gone. I drove along the Gulf of Mexico after my reading, mile after mile after mile, and all of the houses were gone, and all of them, deep inland. And there were trailers of recovery crews. And then at the very end of my drive, where that road dead ends, the Silver Slippers Casino had been completely rebuilt and the parking lot was full, which just seemed surreal to me. I then drove on to New Orleans and stayed in the French Quarter for several days, and I was delighted to see that the French Quarter is coming back, and I understand they had a pretty good jazz festival in terms of numbers of tourists this year. But people still have so much work to do. People have lost their homes. They're still dealing with flood damage. You go into a bar or a restaurant, and there's a stack of water-damaged things in the corner of the room still. And my cousin who lives there is having a terrible time getting insurance payments for the devastation to her house, and people are having a lot of trouble getting insurance to start over again.
Mm-hmm.
There's still trouble with policing and security. And, of course, with labor, the demographics of New Orleans changed radically after Katrina, that they're going back to some degree. New Orleans lost about half of its African-American population in the months following Katrina. And meanwhile, a Hispanic population, which has always been relatively small in New Orleans, more than quadrupled. And so they're also dealing with some fairly intense social shifts in the city.
Isn't it remarkable that 70 years after the 27 flood, we haven't learned a thing?
No, in like the 27 flood in New Orleans, there was, improper planning before the event and selfish acts during and after the event.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elise Blackwell. She's a novelist, and her latest novel is The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish. Now, I want to bring up this observation. Both of your novels derive from the perspective of someone reminiscing from the standpoint of old age. Well, why do you think you're attracted to this looking back kind of perspective?
For me, fiction writing has always been a way of making sense of the world, of pulling different threads together, of setting things side by side, and trying to come to some sort of understanding. The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish, foremost for me, is about our different ways of understanding the world, science, natural history, art, artistic interpretation, historical fact, family story, personal experience. And I think that both of the narrators of my first books are like me in the sense that they are setting down the events of their lives and trying to make sense of them. I did not start out to write my second book. It was originally, from the first-person reminiscing point of view, it was originally told in third person, and after Katrina, when I revised it, I transformed it into a first-person narrative. And I wanted the narrator to have some distance on the events of his childhood. And I'm also fascinated by the idea that even though we've lived the events of our lives, after they're a decade or two, or I can only imagine 8 decades old, it's hard to remember what they felt like, even though we know what happened.
Hmm.
So I wanted to sort of capture that sense of trying to recreate the emotions of youth.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, your protagonists have also both been male, which you have sketched very well indeed. Well, do you think you'll ever delve into women's lives as deeply?
Thanks. And I do believe that people differ more from person to person than from male to female, but it was hard to capture the male point of view, more so the second time. My first narrator of Hunger, was just male from the get-go. The voice came to me as male. The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish, it was a more calculated decision. I sort of wanted to tell the story from the point of view of Lewis's sister, Luda, but in 1927, Louisiana, a young woman would not have had access to some of the places that I needed my character to go to move the plot along, and for sort of very practical reasons of plot, the narrator needed to be male. And I somehow found it harder to get into the point of view of a 17-year-old boy than into an old man. I'm not sure why. After that, I started writing a novel called Dolorosa, told from the female point of view, but I think I'm going to abandon it because I've started something else. My third novel that's coming out is told in multiple points of view, several of them female.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that. But first, I want to bring up the point that your writing is very poetic and sparse, and I wondered who your influences are, if any, in the novel realm.
Well, I have many. I grew up reading a lot of the Southern writers, especially Eudora Welty, short stories, and Faulkner, of course, and Walker Percy. And then I read all kinds of everything, from Thomas Hardy to pop fiction. When I went to graduate school at the University of California, Irvine, one of my professors, and the one who had actually championed me to come into the program, threw my first workshop submission on the table and said, "This is neo-Faulknerian crap, and that's not why we let you in here." I was devastated, and one of the responses I had was to stop writing about the South for a while, and also to really sort of interrogate my writing style, and to a degree he was right, I can admit now, many years later.
Uh-huh.
And I started reading a lot more experimental fiction, and some of my influences have been the work of Michael Ondaatje, particularly his early novels when he was moving from poetry into fiction. Some of the early work of Howard Norman. Andrea Barrett has been an influence because of her writings about science and her use of scientific concepts in scientists as characters in her fiction. My current favorite, though I don't know if he's yet an influence, is W.G. Sebald, the German writer who lived in England.
Yeah, everybody does seem to be influenced by certain styles. Now you have a new, very different novel coming out next month. It's called Grub. Tell us about this one.
Sure. I wrote Grub while I was deciding what to do with the Unnatural History of Cypress Parish, in a part as a reaction out of my, I won't say depression, but out of my discomfort over the idea that that book might never see the light of day. It was also a response to the experiences of many of my friends, mentors and students out there in the publishing world. A lot of them have just chilling horror stories about what happens to their books out there in the world.
Mm.
A friend put in my hands a copy of George Gissing's New Grub Street, which is a satire of the Victorian literary marketplace, and I was struck by both how funny and how sad it was and how relevant it is to today's publishing world. But in other ways, that novel is very dense and dated. It's a Victorian novel. It's quite melodramatic in some of its plot turns, and the fates of all the female characters depend largely on marriage and inheritance due to the time that it was written. And I thought, what fun it would be to update that story. And so Grub is a retelling of New Grub Street set in contemporary New York, and it follows the fortunes of a handful of young novelists trying to make their way in the world, with various commitments to their artistic ideals, and various levels of material ambition, and wildly varying outcomes in their success in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that it's funny. I think it's also a bit nasty.
That sounds good. Now, how did you change some of the women characters to modernize them? Working women, I would assume?
Yes, working and or their fates depend on their own writing and publishing contracts. In my novel, the women are novelists as well as the men, and not merely the wives or daughters of novelists.
Well, we'll look forward to that. We can use some humor.
Thank you. And it's a very different for me. It's written in third person. It's not told from an exclusively male point of view. It's longer, and it's written to be read more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Now, you teach a course called Writing the Novel. How do you approach this subject to new aspiring writers? What do you tell them are the most important points?
Luckily, I teach that course to graduate students, so they have some writing experience already. I find a lot of them are moving from writing short stories to novels, and what they really need to do is learn how to sit in a chair for hours and hours and hours. And I give them some exercises and some advice on how to do that. In my experience, the only way to write a novel is to write almost every day. There are a few writers out there who work differently, but most people who finish writing a novel work on it almost every day. And it's very much about getting them to take the long view. I also give them other general writing advice, and I tell them, too, to write about something that matters to them and potentially to readers, because it's such a huge investment of your time. It's, I think, absurd to spend that much time alone in a room working on something that's not important.
Now, do you think you could be teaching people how to write a novel if you hadn't written some yourself?
No. I don't talk about my own work in my classes, but I do talk to some degree about my own process and my own experience and my own sort of tricks for getting myself in the chair. And I don't think I would have much useful to say if I hadn't written some books myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you working on something else that you can talk to us about? I know the new novel's finished and due out any minute now, so what's new with Elise?
I abandoned what I thought was a perfectly lovely novel that was starting to bore me, Dolorosa, about music, and if I can find a way to reinvigorate it for myself, I might return to it. But I've been gripped by an idea, and I'm working on a novel called Water Damage, which is about art restoration, and is partially set in post-Katrina New Orleans. And one of the images of water-damaged goods sitting in the corner of a restaurant from my recent trip to New Orleans inspired the title. The novel's not about Katrina, but it is set in post-Katrina New Orleans, and one of the main characters is somebody who's working to restore art that was damaged during the hurricane.
Now, do you also write short stories?
I do. I think of myself primarily as a novelist, but I work on short stories often as an exercise or to practice a technique to try something out that I might want to use in a book. Or occasionally I just have an idea that calls for the short form. So I have published some short stories, but I spend most of my time working on novels.
Because it seems like the short story is almost a lost art.
It is, and I think there are people who are short story writers and other people who are novelists. Of course, some people do both beautifully. But it's, again, rather hard to publish a collection of short stories, and a lot of people just want to work on novels. But there are some fantastic short story writers out there.
Now, do you think you'll always be influenced by where you're from in regard to your writing?
I do. It took me a long time to get around to writing about Louisiana again. My first novel set in Leningrad during World War II, of all things.
Very far away from Louisiana.
Yes, cold, northern, entirely different culture. But I still think I'm influenced, even in hunger, with Louisiana. And I found out that Nikolai Vavilov and his colleagues traveled to Louisiana in many, many warm climates. And that sort of idea of heat and steam is always with me, especially now that I'm living in the South again. But more than anything that I take from my upbringing in Louisiana is the storytelling. People down there are great storytellers, so much so that you don't have any idea if your family history is true or not, because you hear so many different versions and embellishments of it that it becomes very hard to separate fact from fiction. But it's not so much about recording fact down there as making sense of it and entertaining with it. And I hope that I will always carry that with me.
And your parents were obviously from the South, or at least brought you up there. How do they feel about your novels? Do they feel you're capturing the essence of the state?
I think so. My father is from Mississippi, which is a whole nother world from Louisiana. My mother and and her parents are from Louisiana, from way back. And my grandmother's family immigrated from France about the time of the Civil War. And, yeah, she seems very pleased. And one thing I did try to do is show some of the complexity of the South. I lived in Princeton, New Jersey for a long time, and I had many friends there who said you couldn't pay them to go to the South. They were afraid that they would be beat up by a sheriff. And I hope that the novel conveys the idea that the South, even the Old South, is a much more complex place. And that there's a strong sort of tradition of literature, science, and learning down here, too, that is easy to get overlooked because we tend to make the news for our less than admirable traits.
Mm-hmm. Now, we only have about a minute left. Can you give us a website or a way that people can get in touch with you if they'd like?
Sure. The University of South Carolina English Department has my email and a website. You can also find me at unbridledbooks.com and tobypress.com.
Well, Elise Blackwell, thank you so much for joining us. And I do highly recommend The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish. I hope people will read it.
Thank you, Tish. It's been a pleasure to be on.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman. Thank you.